KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
He reached out to other religions, other faiths, whether it was Jewish, whether it was Muslim or Islam, he was there.
World leaders and hundreds of thousands of others gathered in St. Peter's Square for the funeral of Pope Francis. For Saturday, April 26th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. We'll hear what happens next at the Vatican. We'll also look back to a key and mysterious moment earlier on in Francis's life. Plus, a former top diplomat's take on Ukraine, Russia, and progress toward peace.
Yeah, I think it's in America's national interest to continue to help deter Putin's army from going further, but obviously President Trump, at least so far, disagrees with that.
And a conversation with a Nobel Peace Prize winner on the future of democracy and press freedom.
We're talking about what is being destroyed, but that also means there's the opportunity to create. It's the reason why I keep going.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump is back in the U.S. after his very brief trip to Vatican City to attend Pope Francis's funeral. As NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports, while there, he met with Ukraine's Zelensky.
The meeting between Trump and Zelensky took place in St. Peter's Basilica shortly before the funeral program began. The White House hasn't released any detail of the conversation between the two leaders, but Trump posted on his social media platform, Truth Social, and said he thinks Russian leader Vladimir Putin might be, quote, tapping me along and doesn't want to end the war. He was critical of Russia's attacks on civilian areas and floated the idea of sanctions against Russia, but provided no further detail. Trump is spending the rest of the weekend at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
Pope Francis was laid to rest in a basilica in Rome today. He's the first pope in more than 100 years to be buried outside of Vatican City. World leaders and hundreds of thousands of others paid their respects to Francis this morning. He died Monday at the age of 88. And NPR's Jason DeRose has more from Rome.
Presidents and kings and princes of the church gathered to bid Francis farewell, also laity and clergy from around the world. The traditional Requiem Mass, sung in Latin, also included prayers in Chinese and Arabic, languages from the global south where the church is vibrant. Following the funeral itself, Francis' body was driven across town over the Tiber River to the Basilica of St. Mary Major for burial. There, he was seen to his final resting place by a group representing those on whom Francis focused his ministry, refugees, homeless people, the poor, and victims of violence. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Rome.
Meanwhile, now that Francis has been laid to rest, a 9-day period of mourning begins, followed by a conclave to select a new pope. Large-scale job cuts at the IRS don't appear to have affected this year's tax filing season. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the agency has processed slightly more returns so far than at this time last year.
More than 140 million people filed tax returns by the week of the April 15th deadline, and so far about 98% of those returns have been processed. That's slightly ahead of last year's pace, even after the IRS laid off thousands of workers this spring. Refunds also appear to be going out on schedule. More than 60% of tax filers get money back from the government. The average refund this year is more than $2,900. About one in six taxpayers waited until the last week to file, but that's not unusual and doesn't appear to have caused any backlog. Many more job cuts are looming at the IRS, though. That's likely to inhibit the agency's ability to go after wealthy tax cheats. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. A third round of talks between Iran and the U.S. over Tehran's nuclear activities ended today after several hours of negotiations between senior officials and teams of technical experts from both sides. A senior administration official says today's talks were positive and productive. Iran's foreign minister told state TV the disagreements remain between the two sides, but that he is cautiously optimistic that they can make progress. Talks will continue soon, with Oman continuing to mediate the talks. A deal could transform Iran's economic and political landscape by easing U.S. sanctions. The son of a famed football coach, Deion Sanders, has been drafted by an NFL team after several days of anticipation that left fans and analysts nervous. NPR's Shonda Lee Stuster has more.
Shedeur Sanders was selected by the Cleveland Browns as the 144th overall pick in the 2025 NFL Draft on Saturday. Sports analysts had expected Sanders to be drafted in the first round, but he was surprisingly passed over by teams during the draft's first 2 days. But Sanders was optimistic, and after Saturday's announcement, thanked the team for giving him a chance. He also said the moment was perfect timing.
Just got to remain positive, stay happy at all times, and know God got you. I knew the whole time God had me, so I wasn't really panicking because I understood it's about perfect timing.
Sanders was a quarterback for the Colorado Buffaloes under his father and named Big 12 Offensive Player of the Year. Shondalise Duster, NPR News.
And I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs, with online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. In Rome today, hundreds of thousands gathered to celebrate the life of Pope Francis. Global leaders, royals, and military men and women joined the cardinals and bishops and other faithful of the church to pay homage to a man who was remembered as the Pope who touched hearts and minds.
Papa Francesco abbia toccato le menti e i cuori.
Francis's funeral was held under crystal blue skies in St. Peter's Square. NPR's Ruth Sherlock takes us there.
Pope Francis's simple wooden casket, as he'd requested, rested before the altar at the entrance to St. Peter's Basilica, the humble center of a grand spectacle.
Dominus pacit me.
Around him was a colourful tapestry, the blood red of the cardinal's robes, the monks in brown that contrasted with the nuns in black and white. The prayers for Pope Francis were held in many languages, in Arabic,
من أجل كنيسة الله المقدسة,
in Portuguese,
pelos povos de todas as nações,
in Mandarin, a global send-off for the Pope.
He reached out to other religions, other faiths, whether it was Jewish, whether it was Muslim or Islam.
Bishop Thomas Masters from Florida is in the crowd of thousands in St. Peter's Square, dressed in his bright purple religious robe.
He built bridges, and he crossed those bridges with people, hand in hand. So we're grateful.
This is a jubilee year in Rome, and millions of Catholic pilgrims were expected to walk these cobbled streets. To this crowd, the Dean of the College of Cardinals, 91-year-old Gian Battista Re, read the homily.
Il plebiscito di manifestazione di affetto e di partecipazione che a tutti abbiamo visto.
He says, the response to Francis's passing from this earth into eternity tells us how the profound pontificate of Francis touched minds and hearts.
Abbia toccato le menti e i cuori.
These include those of young people.
I'm here with friends.
Gianluca Andreone is 13. I ask him what he liked about Francis.
He was really nice to the young and also to the old. To the last one, like the ones that don't have a house or the poorest ones.
Francis cared for the poor, for example, often slipping out of the Vatican to visit homeless shelters nearby. Grand colonnades help close the edges of St. Peter's Square, and above them are 140 statues of Catholic saints. The choir prayed to saints, the voices rising into the sky. Sor Sonia de Oliveira, a Brazilian nun, tells me she's sure Francis is ascending to heaven. This is a day of sadness and of celebration because it's a special moment for Pope Francis, she says. Francis's pontificate, supported by many liberals, was seen as breaking with many traditions and pushing the church towards openness, including by promoting greater roles for women. For example, he appointed a nun to lead an important department or dicastery at the Vatican.
È anche una finestra che si apre. È una finestra che si apre perché fino adesso li vediamo chiaro che la Chiesa è maschile.
This would have been unthinkable before, de Oliveira says. It's a newly opened window for the role of women in the church. The service comes to an end, and preparations are made to take Pope Francis's casket across the city, past ruins of the Roman Forum and the Colosseum, to the resting place he chose at the Basilica of St. Mary Major.
It's going to be a slow procession of cars taking Francis to that church. And we're going to go and see who will be waiting to receive him outside.
Among the crowd waiting outside that basilica is Lucia Latarulo from Bari in South Italy.
Era una persona del popolo e non ci ha fatto sentire la distanza da lui a noi. Siamo tutti uguali. È stato grandissimo Papa Francesco.
Crying, she says, he was a man of the people that never made us feel different from him. Pope Francis shunned luxury and pomp in his papacy for the more ordinary. In his casket, he still wears his classic scuffed black trainers. This human touch will be part of his legacy. Latarulo says this will now be a church to which she will always return when she visits Rome. The cortege arrives.
And here he comes. We're watching from the balconies above. Helicopter overhead.
The casket is brought to the door of St. Mary Major Basilica. Waiting there, invited by the Catholic charity Caritas, are a group from disadvantaged backgrounds. People without homes, migrants, prisoners, victims of war. A fitting last farewell for this Pope who cared. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
Pope Francis's funeral is not the end of the rites and rituals surrounding his death. Over the next few days, leaders of the Catholic Church from around the world will gather at the Vatican to mourn and also to prepare for the conclave, the secretive voting process where they will elect the next pope. To tell us more about what happens next is Silvia Pajoli, who covered Rome and the Vatican for NPR for many years and joins us now from Rome. Hi, Silvia.
Hi, Scott.
So we had the funeral today. What happens next?
Well, it will be followed by 9 days of mourning known as Novendiales. Each day, a different cardinal will lead a public funeral rite. At the same time, the cardinals, both the 135-odd voting-age cardinals and the dozens of over 80-year-olds who are not allowed to enter the conclave to elect the papal successor, they'll all meet in what are called congregations every day for at least 1 week. These are very important meetings because it's then that many of the cardinals will get to know each other for the first time. You know, Francis appointed some 80% of the voting age cardinals. He selected some from areas of the world where there never had been any cardinals before in history. Some of them are from very far away places, have visited the Vatican very rarely. And so this is going to be a very important time for all of them to exchange views and to discuss the state of the Catholic Church, what they think should be its future direction, its primary focus, and so forth. It's a time when cardinals assess each other, they start making alliances, and they start working on promoting their candidates or even themselves as future popes.
Yeah, in fact, the last two popes, Francis and Benedict, really did seem to establish themselves as front runners with speeches and actions they took during this period of time. Can you remind us what both of them did?
Well, in 2005, after the death of Pope John Paul II, the dean of the College of Cardinals was Joseph Ratzinger, who had been very close to John Paul for years. Ratzinger gave the homily at the Pope's funeral, in which he painted a very bleak picture of the Catholic Church in an increasingly secularized world. A refrain of his homily was the words, "Follow me," the words the risen Christ had said to Peter. It was a phrase that could have been interpreted as Ratzinger's appeal to his fellow cardinals to opt for continuity in their choice of John Paul's successor. In fact, in the conclave, after the ballot in 2 days, Ratzinger was elected and he took the name Benedict XVI. But then Benedict resigned in 2013, saying he felt too old to deal with administering the Vatican, which was afflicted by a lot of scandals. Mm-hmm. In one of those pre-conclave meetings, the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, Jorge Mario Bergoglio, made a brief speech known as an intervention that very much impressed his fellow cardinals. He said that if the church has a self-referential spirit, that interferes with its ability to carry out its mission. And after five ballots in just 24 hours, Bergoglio was elected and became the first pope to take the name Francis. Now, normally, cardinals' interventions are secret, but it so happens that Bergoglio gave his notes to another cardinal who, with his permission, later published what apparently became the blueprint for the Francis papacy.
Have there been times where people who go into this period as front runners undercut themselves or weaken their candidacies in one way or another?
Well, there's an old expression which everybody is repeating these days here. He who enters the conclave as a pope leaves it as a cardinal, meaning often the so-called favorites are the losers. As usual, there's a lot of speculation on who has the best chance, and there are several so-called papabili, Vatican insiders and cardinals far out in the field.
All right, so given that, Sylvia, I'm not going to ask you to name any specific front runners, but in terms of the big picture direction the church might go, any sense which way the cardinals could be leaning here?
I think the cardinals have very hard decisions to make. The Francis papacy is one that was in many ways revolutionary. And just before dying, he was an increasingly isolated moral voice in a world that seems to be shifting more and more toward nationalism, populism, and authoritarianism. It's quite ironic, I think, that the late leader of the Catholic Church had become the messenger of liberal values on the world stage.
Right. That is Sylvia Pagioli reporting from Rome. Sylvia, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
And when the Papal Conclave begins, all things considered, we'll bring you live coverage from the Vatican. I will be with the NPR team broadcasting from St. Peter's Square and waiting for white smoke. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Pope Francis has been laid to rest in Rome. This is world leaders and dignitaries, along with hundreds of thousands, gathered this morning to pay respects to Francis at his funeral. He died Monday at the age of 88. The Indian Army says Indian and Pakistani troops exchanged gunfire for a second straight night along the militarized border in disputed Kashmir. This gunfire follows a deadly attack on tourists earlier this week, blamed on Pakistani militants. And the first black Secretary of Labor has died. Alexis Herman was praised as a trailblazer for civil rights. She was 77 years old. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the University of Buffalo. The University of Buffalo is developing new AI technologies with the goal of solving some of society's most pressing challenges. More at buffalo.edu/AI. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow. President Trump met with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky at the Vatican this morning. A photo shows the two leaders sitting face-to-face, huddled together in seemingly deep conversation on the sidelines of Pope Francis's funeral. The White House says the two had, quote, a very productive discussion. And on social media earlier today, President Trump criticized his Russian counterpart, writing, quote, there was no reason for Putin to be shooting missiles into civilian areas. It makes me think that maybe he doesn't want to stop the war. He's just tapping me along. This all comes a day after U.S. Envoy Steve Witkoff met with President Putin in Moscow to discuss a possible end to the war in Ukraine. Here to talk about what all of this high-level diplomacy means is Michael McFaul. He served as the U.S. ambassador to Russia during the Obama administration and is currently the director of the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this meeting. What do you make of the meeting? What do you make of the fact that afterward Trump posted on social media criticizing Vladimir Putin, not Volodymyr Zelensky?
Well, I'm glad they had the meeting. Anytime they can meet, especially one-on-one, without cameras, without staff, that's always a good thing, because then President Zelensky gets to explain his position directly to President Trump. The reaction from President Zelensky on social media was very positive, and other staff people have said positive things. And as you just noted, President Trump also did criticize Putin. He suggested that maybe he's not serious about peace and that there should be sanctions. And that's, in my view, a correct assessment of where Putin has been so far. And that would be a correct prescription to try to put pressure on Russia, something President Trump and his team have never done. But I'd also point out that President Trump sounds always tough on social media and says a lot of things rhetorically and very rarely follows up with concrete actions when we're talking about pressure on Putin, pressure on Russia.
This is at the funeral of Pope Francis, who pushed for several years now for peace in Ukraine. In a different way, Trump and the Trump administration have been pressuring Ukraine to cut a deal to end the war. Trump said yesterday he thinks Ukraine and Russia are close. How do you read that? What do you think is happening in the coming weeks? Do you think this war could end?
I'm not sure. I worry that Putin is not serious about ending this war. I think Putin thinks time's on his side. Trump and his team will eventually get frustrated and walk away. They'll cut military assistance to Ukraine. And that's all in Putin's favor for continuing the war and to try to conquer the territory on the ground that he has already annexed on paper. You buy a map in Russia today, and it has four of those regions of Ukraine as part of the Russian Federation.
Curious what your best realistic read is right now, not what you would like to see, but what you think is realistic. What you think the best position Ukraine could be in some sort of peace deal could be at this moment, given the manpower, given the dug-in front, and given the fact that under President Trump, the U.S. is very clear that it's not going to continue supporting Ukraine in the way that the U.S. did for several years of this war. Like, what do you think the best-case scenario is here for Ukraine?
Well, I would disconnect two different things that get conflated. There's a ceasefire, and then there's a permanent peace agreement to end the war. And I think those are two very different things. I think most immediately, getting a ceasefire And even if it has to be a minimum one, getting a ceasefire that both sides say we are not going to attack civilian targets, that would be a great achievement for the Ukrainians. Remember, Putin constantly, every day, and just a few days ago, again in their capital of Kyiv, is attacking civilian targets. I call that terrorism. That would be great to end. And then that moment, if you got to a ceasefire, could create the permissive conditions for a longer negotiation that I think could go on for months, if not years, about some permanent peace settlement. And I'm not optimistic they would ever get it, but at least the war would stop without forcing Zelensky to acknowledge annexation. And I think, tragically, that's probably the best outcome that Ukraine can hope for today, with the long-term expectations that they would buy time for the Europeans to help provide the weapons that we are no longer going to. And I say that tragically. I think it's in America's national interest to continue to help deter Putin's army from going further. But obviously, President Trump, at least so far, disagrees with that.
That's Michael McFaul, former U.S. ambassador to Russia, now with Stanford University. Thanks again for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Hundreds of millions of dollars from oil and gas companies are flowing to universities around the U.S., funding everything from student scholarships to research. Fueling Knowledge is a two-part series from the WWNO and WRKF podcast Sea Change, produced with Floodlight and the Louisiana Illuminator. In this excerpt, reporters Holly Parker and Pam Radke explore whether that funding from the fossil fuel industry comes with strings attached. Their focus, the oil and gas-branded campus of Louisiana's flagship university, LSU.
Jeffrey Suprin grew up in the UK. When he was only 16 years old, he started researching renewable energy. He put his head down, ready to dedicate his life to the lab, a physicist through and through. He didn't really think twice back then that his PhD was being paid for by an oil company.
The only perspective I had on this oil company was that it paid for my PhD and it threw fancy banquets for us and gave us, you know, fancy logoed stationery.
Suprin was halfway into his studies at MIT, dreaming up new technologies to combat climate change. But then one day in his lab, he had an epiphany. The fossil fuel industry itself was the biggest obstacle to solving this crisis. Suprin took off his lab coat and decided to study something different: the fossil fuel industry's history of disinformation and propaganda. Now, when he looks back, he says that for all of his scientific smarts, he was naive.
It took me a long time to realize that the photo ops, the public statements about their sponsorship deals with MIT, were part and parcel of a public affairs scheme that massively outsized me and my individual project.
He says he was subtly, unwittingly being used by the oil company. And it's not just him. Huge donations by oil and gas companies pay for labs like his and far more at universities around the world. Actual professors, scholarships, new buildings, influential research. And Suprin, no longer that naive PhD student, is worried.
Universities are at risk of being pawns in a climate propaganda scheme devised and implemented by fossil fuel interests for decades.
Last fall, Suprin and other researchers released a comprehensive study detailing how the fossil fuel industry is embedded in universities around the world. And it's dangerous. He says it mirrors another time in history when industry manipulated universities to buy public opinion.
It's a situation exactly parallel to public health researchers being funded by the tobacco industry. It's a conflict of interest the size of an oil tanker.
Suprin says the fossil fuel industry is working from a well-worn playbook. We reached out to the American Petroleum Institute, which represents oil and gas companies through lobbying and advocacy efforts. They sent us a statement saying the industry is proud to partner with leading universities to prepare the next generation of engineers, scientists, and problem solvers to tackle the world's greatest energy challenges.
What Suprin is worried about, the fossil fuel industry using universities to get the study results that they want? Well, I found an example of it LSU has another research hub that it formed back in the 80s. It's called the Center for Energy Studies. The center was created to help inform Louisiana state lawmakers about energy policy, specifically how to keep the oil and gas flowing.
Today, many of the center's reports are sponsored by a who's who in Louisiana petrochemicals. Usually these companies want to know the economic impact of a particular project, number of jobs and tax dollars created, that sort of thing.
Scrolling through pages and pages of these research contracts, one caught my eye. It was sponsored by a big Texas law firm called Bracewell. It's well known for its oil and gas lobbying.
Bracewell was working with a company that's proposed a huge carbon capture project in Louisiana. The company wants to store millions of tons of carbon dioxide underground in southwest Louisiana. And they want to show how it would benefit the state's economy. So they turned to LSU for an economic impact study.
But what they asked for wasn't a purely objective scientific study.
In the end, LSU's researchers wrote a report that listed all of the financial reasons the Gulf Coast should welcome this new industry. But the economic risks, it barely mentions any of those.
And the red flags kept popping up. One of the biggest was that LSU's contract allows funders to give feedback on the draft before it's published. It also lets the funder stay anonymous if they want, meaning the public would never know who paid for the report. Unless, of course, they filed a public records request like we did.
We went back to Jeffrey Supran, our fossil fuel propaganda expert, and showed him the agreement and final report.
It's like it gets a D grade, and it's not quite an F. The fact that this report just touts the economic benefits of this specific company funding the report, it kind of makes you wonder if it's worth the paper it's written on.
He was stunned LSU would even give the funder the option to stay anonymous. This report did name the funder, but
if they exercised it, it would blatantly disregard basic academic norms in terms of disclosing fundamental conflicts of interest.
When we asked the authors of the LSU report for an interview, one declined to comment and the other never responded. The head of LSU's research office defended the agreement. He told us that the contract's terms are standard across the university and that he found no problems with the report.
Now, technically, LSU is allowed to do all of this. It's not illegal, nor does it fall neatly in the box of research misconduct like using fake data or plagiarizing. But reports like these, written in language that someone like, say, a lawmaker could understand, could influence decision-making, because they carry the credibility of a university.
This got us thinking, how do elected officials use reports from schools like LSU to decide on policy? So Hallie went to talk with one.
Devontae Lewis, and I'm the Public Service Commissioner for the 3rd District of Louisiana.
As a commissioner, Lewis regulates the electric grid, among other things, which is huge when you're thinking about the energy transition. He's always deep in government reports or research papers from universities.
The research plays a significant role in determining whether or not we're on the right or wrong course.
He says he relies on credible, independent information to decide how he votes on new regulations. And he's worried. As more industry money pays for research, policymakers might not get the full picture.
The source is important. I mean, oftentimes we have seen where money drives facts, not facts drive money.
This idea that money drives facts, not facts drive money, that's exactly what motivated our reporting.
Lewis's concern that bad research will lead to bad policy is really a national problem. One so bad that Democrats in Congress investigated big oil over it. And they found the world's top oil and gas companies were systematically delaying action to fix global warming with this research.
But identifying this playbook hasn't been enough to stop it in the past. People still smoke cigarettes, and a lot more people still support the oil and gas industry, especially in Louisiana. Why? Because all those donations aren't only going to research. There's another chapter in this playbook.
The fossil fuel industry doesn't just influence people's minds. They've captured their hearts too.
That was an excerpt from Fueling Knowledge, a special series from the Sea Change podcast in collaboration with reporters at Floodlight and Louisiana Illuminator. We should note that the carbon sequestration company involved in the economic impact research did not respond to a request for comment. Bracewell, the law firm, shared general details about their work with universities, but did not comment on the specifics of this research agreement. You can hear the full investigation wherever you get your podcasts. Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Just over 4 days in April, a group of women from all over the world, from Kenya to France to the United States, traveled to South Africa to prove just how tough older women can be. The event, the Grannies International Football Tournament, which is, of course, soccer to us. Reporter Ryan Lenora Brown sends us this story.
It's a hot, sticky April morning in Nkoankoa, South Africa. A parade of soccer teams streams into the local stadium. One of them sings a fight song. The words translate to something like, "We're going to play ball. The grannies are going to play soccer." Think of this as a World Cup of sorts, one exclusively for women over 50. Teams from seven countries have come to this South African farming town to compete. Two squads from Boston hand out tiny American flags to the crowd. Many of these teams are fielding players in their 70s or even 80s. And the soccer is good, like really good. Lillian Zulu is a 54-year-old grandmother from Zambia.
I've got my talent in football. It's the way I run. I'm very quick. I play like Messi, you know. It's a joke.
It's not really, though. Zulu is the captain of Team Zambia, and she is lightning quick. This is the second edition of the Grannies International Football Tournament. But many players are here for the first time. And this is a kind of adoration they never dreamed of. Here's French player Anne Ozebi, who is 52.
It was like when a dream come true, you know? Like if you were professional football players.
I also meet Fikile Sitole, age 55, who has actually known some soccer fame. In the 1990s, she was part of post-apartheid South Africa's first women's national team. And now, she's back on the pitch.
We train, we try and push ourselves. Let's do something, let's not just sit. Because it's going to help us tomorrow, and it's going to take us long to get old.
These days, she's playing for a granny's team from the city of Mbombela. She and her teammates glide across the field, using a well-known South African style called shoeshine and piano, with dance-like footwork and tight passes. They storm all the way to the semifinals and lead that game until the final 5 minutes. But then, their French opponents come roaring back. It's a crushing defeat. But as soon as the game is over, players from the opposing sides pull each other into sweaty hugs. It's like that at this tournament. On the field, no one holds back. And in the stands, it's basically a non-stop party led by the South Africans. In the end, an American team wins the tournament. But there's also an award you wouldn't expect at a soccer tournament. In a black tracksuit wrapped in a Kenyan flag, Tala Kaino takes the stage. She is 87 years old. A fitting way to end a tournament that doesn't see aging as something to run from. Here, in fact, it's a badge of honor. For NPR News, I'm Ryan Lenora Brown.
This is NPR News.
After
After the funeral, the conclave, Vincent Nichols will be there.
When those doors shut, all of the, you know, it's conservative against liberal and all of that stuff, that will finish.
The thoughts and prayers of one cardinal as he prepares to vote for the next pope. That and all the latest news Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. President Trump met briefly with Ukraine's President Zelensky in Rome ahead of the Pope's funeral. This after his last meeting in the White House in February ended abruptly. The White House says today's meeting was productive. In southern Iran, at least 8 people are dead, dozens wounded after a huge explosion in a port. It happened as the U.S. and Iranian officials were holding another round of nuclear talks, which will continue next week. And the Cleveland Browns selected Colorado quarterback Shedeur Sanders in the 5th round of the NFL draft today. He is the son of NFL Hall of Famer and Buffalo's coach, Deion Sanders. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru. In partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. On Friday, the Justice Department rescinded a Biden-era policy that provided protections for journalists in leak investigations. The change paves the way for authorities to potentially use subpoenas and compel testimony from reporters in probes targeting leakers. This is the type of announcement that worries Maria Ressa, especially when viewed in the context of scores of other moves made by the Trump White House. Ressa is a Nobel Peace Prize winner who for years has been a champion of press freedoms around the world. Ressa co-founded the investigative news site Rappler in 2012 in her home country of the Philippines, and it was there that she spent years covering the administration of the country's former president, Rodrigo Duterte, and his violent war on drugs. Her reporting made Ressa the target of that administration, and she was arrested a number of times until she was ultimately convicted of libel in 2020. Now, Ressa has a stark warning that the United States of America is sliding toward authoritarianism at an alarming rate. She joins me now to talk more about it. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let me start with this. How much of what is happening in America in 2025 feels familiar to you?
Oh my God, I feel like it's both deja vu and I have PTSD, you know, very, very familiar. And it actually unleashed, I suppose, what is like suppressed anger at the pit of my stomach. So I'm trying to control that too.
There's a lot of things happening right now in the world of concerns about authoritarianism, the world of press freedom.
Yep.
What are some of these specific things over the past 100 or so days that you have said, this is bad?
I mean, on every front. You know, look, in the Philippines, under Rodrigo Duterte, we have a constitution like the United States. It's patterned after the United States, 3 co-equal branches of government. And under Duterte, that collapsed within 6 months of taking office. All of these moves that he had done have accelerated in the United States. And I would say, you know, let's look at them in phases, right? There are 4 levels that I keep thinking of. You know, the accelerant, of course, is technology,
yeah,
right? Because our public information ecosystem on social media literally is on the side of lies. The second level of attack will be news organizations, media. And in the Philippines, we talked about it as the three C's: corrupt, coerce, co-opt. When you get that, then you move to the next layer, academe. After that, it's NGO. So academe, NGO, and then the last layer is state capture. You capture every single one, and as you move up the ranks, your rule of law diminishes. Rule of law begins to collapse. You normalize things that would have been not just illegal, but criminal.
One of the storylines of these past 100 days has been the way that President Trump has targeted one institution or another in a variety of different ways. Columbia University, where I should say you're currently teaching, the first in a wave of colleges being targeted, saying these grants are at risk unless you change certain things. Big law firms that typically act with Democratic organizations or actors saying, we're going to put all sorts of consequences on you unless you cut a deal. I could go on, but you have seen so many examples of organizations saying, you know what? We are going to take that deal because we still want to survive. But I feel like everybody imagines themselves, would I stand up or would I not when I face pressure like that? You were in that situation. Your news organization was targeted. You were arrested. I imagine there could have been many times where you would have thought or said, you know what, somebody else could do this. I would like to not be in jail. Did you ever come close to cutting some sort of deal? And what did you think about in those moments when you realized the pressure was on you?
You know, you don't know who you are until you're forced to fight for it. If I had left, I would have weakened the press collectively. Because, silence is consent, but literally giving up, volunteering to give up your rights? I guess I felt like I'm old enough. At that point, I came under attack when I was in my 50s. And I was like, if I really believe in these values, I'm just going to have to move forward. And the crazy thing is that you don't know what will work. You just take it step by step by step. And my guiding light, the North Star, are the values you live by. And I think this is the challenge for everyone. People want instant answers. But the battle to retain your rights, don't voluntarily give up your rights. I felt like I couldn't do this both for myself. Like, how would I wake up and look in the mirror the next day? But also, how do I face the people I recruited? Mm-hmm. The people who believe in this. And even worse than that is, what does that mean for your ideals? I wasn't willing to kill it. And ultimately, in the end, and I think this is the best advice, whatever it is you're most afraid of, you have to embrace your fear. And think it out. Think through the worst case scenario. Workflow it in Rappler. We drilled it. And then once you knock that out, then you can stand up and stand by your values. These times matter.
There is a lot of evidence that a lot of people in the country simply do not care what a reporter and an expert have to say about this topic and the dire warnings being said into microphones, including somebody who won the Nobel Peace Prize. Or maybe even because of, right? There is an anti-expert sentiment that is real in this country. There is an anti-media sentiment that is real in this country. It is a pervasive thing. And I'm sure there's people hearing this who are rolling their eyes at what we are saying. How do you respond to that moment? How, as someone who has deep concerns, do you get a message through in that moment?
I think it's what we did in the Philippines is to move into the physical world, right? You know, the work that we've done in Rappler shows you that it all begins with the corrupted environment of our technology. The public information ecosystem literally has manipulated our realities, has, you know, if it is illegal in the world to segregate people in the physical world, we're segregated online. And a growth algorithm, the friends of friends algorithm, literally has caused the polarity that we're living through. So I actually will keep doing the stories, will keep speaking. And if I see you face to face and we think different things, I'll engage with you in the way that we should. I think this is what journalists do. So there's a lot to unpack there, because it isn't just like this person believes this because of this person has been insidiously manipulated. And does that mean we stop trying to reach the person? Absolutely not.
That is Maria Ressa, co-founder of the investigative news site Rappler and winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The man remembered today at a funeral in St. Peter's Square, Pope Francis, was once very different. There was a period of time decades ago when he was viewed as arrogant, aloof, as someone who caused so much discord that he was essentially exiled from the Argentinian Jesuit order he had once led. Francis has referred to this two-year window, which happened when he was in his 50s, as a dark night and a crisis in his life. NPR's religion editor, Daniel Burke, reported deeply on this period of time in then-Father Jorge Bergoglio's life. So, for today's Reporter's Notebook, on the day of Pope Francis's funeral, we are talking to Daniel about what he learned about that period of exile in Cordoba and how he went about his reporting. Hi, Daniel.
Hello.
Okay, so let's set the stage here. This is early on, relatively, the first couple years of Francis's papacy. You are covering it for CNN. What was it about this period on his resume that drew you? Why did you think this is something I want to spend a lot of time and resources investigating?
Shortly after he was elected Pope in 2013, there were timelines of his life produced by the Catholic Church. And there was this gap, as you said, from 1990 to 1992, in which he was essentially doing nothing. A very menial job at a parish in the city of Cordoba, far from his home city. And I thought, well, that's interesting. He goes from being a really powerful Jesuit to doing nothing. And then he's a powerful archbishop. What is going on here? Why was he sent to this place? What did he do here? And so I went with kind of an open mind. The thing that I discovered that kept me going is the fact that he won't talk about it. And that's when I thought, oh, wow, there must be something really here that is still emotionally resonant for him.
And he never did at any point in his papacy. He had that memoir come out, and he just glancingly referenced it in that.
One line. He just calls it a dark night. And so, yeah, I was looking to that memoir to try to get some more insights to this period of his life, because it's still somewhat of a mystery to me, to be honest. But he, even friends, said it was like too painful for him to talk about. It was still like an open wound until the end of his life. He wrote that memoir when he was 87, right?
So. Yeah. And it must have been hard to report then, though, given that. You can't call him up and say, hey, tell me about this.
Right, exactly. I wrote him a letter, but he did not answer, of course, right? But his friends, who, again, said he didn't talk about it, but still talked to him during this period and saw him, the story began to come together of what he was like at this time of his life, why he was sent away for this period, because he was creating division among the Jesuits. He had this view that priests should, he still said this as Pope, should smell like their sheep, which means like be in touch with the people, with the flock. In Argentina, he meant that literally. He wanted Jesuits to work on farms, to help feed poor people, to milk the cows, to harvest the crops. And there were Jesuits in Argentina who didn't want to do that at all. They were intellectual. They wanted to spend their time teaching. Mm-hmm. And so there was basically split into two camps, the Pope Francis camp and the other camp. And because of those divisions, he was sent away 500 miles away from his birth city, Buenos Aires. And when he's there, as I said, he has no real job. He is supposed to kind of finish his doctoral dissertation, but like a lot of PhD students is not so interested in that. You know, inspiration's fire has dimmed a little bit. So he spends a lot of time praying, spends a lot of time reading, writing some essays. But he refers to it as a time of purification and as a dark night.
Is it fair to say, based on the reporting you did, that the person who emerges from this period of time is different from the person who came into it?
Without a doubt. The people closest to him, and I managed to get in touch with Jesuits who were as close to him as friends can be, say that this was a different guy. The Jesuits take a vow of obedience, right? And it's one thing, obedience, that vow is one thing when you're on the top. Mm-hmm. When you're on the bottom and you're getting sent away from your community to this menial job, it's quite a different thing. The man who emerged was not as authoritarian. He's much more consulting with other people. He's much more willing to listen to other people and to compromise. So they said they noticed a discernible change when he comes out of this. He is in some ways freer, but also much more chill about living with other people and being in community with other people.
How did learning all of this information and putting the story together and better understanding this period of time that, again, he never wanted to talk about, how did that help you better understand the papacy going forward, the person going forward that you were covering?
Yeah, so he's got this amazing quote that I found that he told a politician who basically was voted out of office. And what he said to this politician is, you have to live your exile. and you will come back kinder and more merciful and be prepared to serve your people. And when I saw that quote, I thought, oh, that has the ring of real experience behind it, right? Mm-hmm. So he is clear and was clear throughout his papacy that he was fallible. He said that he had made mistakes. And I think he had a keen sense from this period of what it's like to be fallible, of what it's like to be seen as an outcast, someone who's not wanted by the church or the community. And so he had a heart for those kind of people. If you see him talking to people on the margins, he's always welcoming them into the church. He had this evocative phrase that he wanted it to be a field hospital and not a fortress. And so when I see him talking about mercy so much for all manner of sinners, it's hard for me not to think of this period in his life when he was cast out because of his perceived sins.
I think what's also interesting, kind of veering away from the story in itself, is that you see a different person come out of this experience than who went into it. You also saw a different person emerge from the conclave than the cardinal who went into it, right? Like, I think it is fair to say that Pope Francis was very different in a lot of ways than Cardinal Bergoglio. And as we all prepare to see a new person step out on the balcony and immediately Google their life history, how much of an open mind do you think people should keep in terms of how different somebody can be when they're suddenly in a new position of power like a papacy?
That's a great question, because you talk to people in Argentina who knew him, and even in Buenos Aires, after this period, right? He was kind of known as a sourpuss. In the period of Cordoba that I wrote about, when he heard confessions, Catholics did not want to go to him. He was known as being strict. They called him Father Sourface. And so they actually avoided him. Imagine that, avoiding the future pope.
Yeah.
At just a parish in Argentina.
Not that guy.
Exactly. And then you see this pope emerge, yeah. St. Peter's Basilica, smiling, kissing babies, so happy. Even his sister said the office changed the man. He seems freer, he seems happier, he smiles more. So I think, you know, Catholics talk a lot about the Holy Spirit. And there's some Catholics who say that his personality changes are only explainable in that kind of supernatural way, that he was so different mm-hmm. when he became Pope, so joyful. That was really a change.
I'm wondering how you as a person were affected by this assignment, and what, if any, lessons you drew out of it about how sometimes your life can take a wrong turn in terms of how you think it should go.
Yeah. I think what's striking about this moment in the Pope's life, he was in his 50s, right? And he was a rising star in the Jesuit order. And then he's sent down to this little parish and has to kind of reckon with that. Like, what is my life now? What does it mean to me? He kind of had his purpose taken away from him. And so, you know, I'm approaching that age, and I think about that a lot. I think a lot about both my own aspirations, but like, the world doesn't care about my aspirations, right? Like, there's going to be something that happens regardless. And I think what I learned from him and what I learned from this period is so much is dependent on how you handle those situations, right? Like, he could have gone into this period and really just moped and left the Jesuit order or left the church, and not really used it in the way he did, which was to make himself a better person mm-hmm. At the end of the day. And I think there's some lessons in that for all of us, maybe.
That is NPR religion editor Daniel Burke. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott.
And that is All Things Considered for this Saturday. Thank you so much for joining us. We will talk to you again tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
back home, I'll admit I've done you wrong. I've lied and I've cheated, now you're gone. I had a heart all full of strife, foolish pride messed up my life. I'll admit I've done you wrong, come back home. Come back home, all I have is misery. Every day I'm blue and lonesome as I can be. I wanna undo the wrong I've done. Without you, life just can't go on. I'll admit I've done you wrong. Come back home.